This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Nation, welcome to this NBA playoff edition of the NBA Team Podcast. I am so glad to be back here. It's the playoffs. It's finally here. We talk about it all regular season on the NBA Team show, and now we're finally here. Unfortunately, my buddy Adam Murray is not here. He is still hovering around in Europe, looking at all the sights of the world, even though he's been tripping on over there more than a few times. But he will be back soon, so I had to find a fill-in, and I think I found a good one here. He is my good old buddy. We go way, way, way back, back towards the days where we didn't actually even talk to each other through Skype. But he's I'm going to talk about him and his background as an NBA fan a little bit, but let me go ahead and introduce him. People on the Place to Be Nation network of podcasts will definitely be familiar with this name, and his name is... The beret wearing Todd Weber.
I am not wearing my beret. I'm wearing my Trilby hat.
Your Trilby hat?
Is that Trilby? Yeah, like a newsboy hat.
Well, does it make you feel more professional when you do that?
I do. It still's got the old tag on it. In fact, so
now when you do Place to Be Nation podcast, do you wear it? Does it make you feel like you're doing a better job?
I feel that when I put the hat on, I become a different person. In fact, I become a person who doesn't stutter. He speaks a little more slowly, but he always brings the good content. So I am hat-wearing Todd Weber.
Okay, now I don't hit any of those three marks, so you're going to have to pick me up there.
I'll do my best.
Now, before we get started, I want to because I always do this for everybody who and also thanks for coming along. But I wanted to go ahead and... just kind of get your background as an NBA fan, because I love to dip into that before we started getting to the nitty-gritty, just to give people an idea of where you come from as an NBA fan. You're from California, so people would think that you have all these stories about being a Laker fan or maybe a Warriors fan, but tell me the real story.
Well, my story begins in 1979 when I was 7 years old. My parents were divorced, and the NBA finals were on late at night. It was not... we didn't have the cable landscape we do now. We didn't even have prime time. We would show reruns of the games, or we'd show the games first run, but after prime time sports were on, or prime time TV shows were on. And so the 1979 NBA Finals of the Los Angeles Lakers versus the Philadelphia 76ers, where that's my earliest NBA memory.
Oh, the Magic Johnson triple-double.
That was, yeah. Kareem was out, and so they started Magic... rookie Magic Johnson at the center, and he had a triple-double in that last game, and it was got me hooked on basketball for life. And I was initially a Lakers fan. This was 1979. I had no options up here in Northern California except for the Warriors, and they weren't on TV. I didn't know much about them.
And the Kings were in Kansas City.
Right, for a long time yet. My parents, like I said, split up, and so my mom eventually moved to Utah, and she married a guy who had Jazz season tickets. So I followed the Utah Jazz very religiously.
After they stole my team.
Yeah, they moved from New Orleans and Pistol Pete's. Yeah, the Utah never renamed the team. That would never fly at this point, but it's been too long. I mean, Utah Jazz makes
sense. Well, the idiot owner for New Orleans sold all the naming rights just hand over fist. He was like, just get them off of my hands.
Yeah, it's a great name, a great franchise of the old 70s with Pistol Pete. So
I
grew up watching guys like Adrian Dantley and Daryl Griffith from Louisville.
Big old Mark Eaton.
Mark Eaton, 7'4" shot blocker, greatest shot blocker I'd ever seen for many, many years. Rich Kelly.
Thurl Bailey.
Thurl the Pearl Bailey. Yeah.
Pearl.
loved the Utah Jazz, but then I moved back to California in 1985, and coincidentally, The Kansas City Kings were sold to a group from Sacramento, and the league allowed them to move to Sacramento in that same year. So I kind of adopted them because it was the hometown thing. I went to lots of Kings games, and I've been hooked ever since. Ups and downs of these 31 years of the Sacramento Kings here in Sacramento proper.
A lot of ups, a lot of downs, recently downs. Another thing that's going to be going down soon is the Arco Arena, which is now named the Sleep Train Arena. Are you going to miss it?
I will miss it. I bought my first house in 2009, and we just moved recently this past year. And I was lucky enough to live 5 minutes away from Sleep Train Arena. So I could almost walk to the games if I really, really wanted to.
And a lot of fans would be asleep in the stands lately, right?
One thing about the Kings, this is a fan base that saved its team from going to Seattle. It wasn't necessarily Kevin Johnson, although he was very involved, Vivek Ranadive. It was the fans who rose up, fought for the team, had made pledges to the organization. Well, if you stay, we'll buy more tickets. We'll support more advertising. And then, it was a grassroots effort with we had documentaries and things. This was a very passionate, loyal fan base. This is all we have. We don't have any other sports here in Sacramento. We have the National Basketball Association's Kings, and we're going to have them for another 35 years because they just signed a lease at the new Golden One Center in downtown Sacramento, which is going to be a lot harder for me to go to games.
And you're a true Kings fan. I know it on Twitter. I see it all the time. Because we're going to be quickly getting, for the listeners, getting to our playoff previews, just give me the Cliff Notes version on DeMarcus Cousins, just your general opinion.
I think he's a supremely talented player who's still obviously has emotional issues. He's not a true leader. Usually you want your best player on the team, and he is by far their best talented player to be your leader. And he's just not. I don't know where that's come from, but I think they're going to give it one more go, one more year. Now, they may get a sweetheart deal from Boston or a team with draft picks and rebuilding, but with the new arena opening, I think even though the fan base is somewhat split on Boogie this last year, he didn't really. He and Carl were at odds, and he had some opportunities to just man up. And after they had a really strong win streak, and they had a triple overtime, he lost to Charlotte.
That was where Boogie went for like 50 plus.
But something changed in him after that game. He just said, "I'm not getting the help from either my team, my coaches, or the refs." And he's always had that chip on his shoulder where the refs, and he hasn't done himself any favors. He's been adversarial with the refs from day one. But and be just demonstrably upset with calls. And the thing about Boogie, though, is he loves this town. And it's going to be awfully hard to find somebody to replace that in the community. It's going to be hard to find a superstar, as flawed as he is, as temperamental as he is. He's still only 25 years old, to replace that in Sacramento. He is shy guy. He doesn't like the high media profile. He would really, really falter under the microscope of a team like the Knicks or the Lakers, where there's giant media sources. And here, the team has been able to shield him a little bit from some of the scrutiny. Now there's national scrutiny for Boogie. Everybody and their brother thinks that the team's been in the wrong with the George Karl situation as far as the player's not playing for him. Carl's a legendary coach, Hall of Fame coach. Why wouldn't you give him a little bit more root? But that's a very complicated issue.
Yeah, there was something involving apparel affiliations that he didn't, or shoe affiliations that kind of bled into it as well. Even where the truth is and where fiction is, it's all kind of like mixed together.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to say.
We really are. We don't know everything.
And as a New Orleans fan, who watched Baron Davis bolt and who watched Chris Paul get a trade out of here to Los Angeles, I feel for you. It's always sad to watch small market teams kind of prepare themselves mentally for the postmortem of a player that hasn't departed yet. But we'll see for Todd Weber. There still is hope there, obviously, like he was saying, and we're going to be keeping an eye on the Kings. But the Kings are not in the playoffs. However, one team that is in the playoffs and is in a very, very good position in the playoffs to do very well in the Eastern Conference, which is what we're going to be previewing for this playoff preview today, is a team that actually also fired their coach, just like the Kings, and that was the Cleveland Cavaliers. Now, Todd, there, we could talk about the Cavaliers and their strengths and their weaknesses and all that, but let's just start from the top and the biggest story that hovered around Cleveland this year, and that was the firing of David Blatt. He was 30-11 going in. They had a miserably bad performance against the Golden State Warriors, I believe on Martin Luther King Day, and then Blatt got the axe, replaced by the lead assistant, who was Tyronn Lue. Did you like the move, and have you really seen a difference out of Cleveland since the move was made?
Okay, so general manager and part owner, I think LeBron James made that call. Now, they will deny that. He denied it. You know, he told Brian Windhorst that I had nothing to do with this, but come on. Yeah. LeBron fired David
Blatt. David Griffin, the general manager, is just trying to give just enough transparency for us to think that it really was his decision.
So. Such hooey. It is LeBron's call, and it has been since day one. Now, they gave Blatt a year and a half, and he I'm sure he's a good coach. He wouldn't have gotten to the league if he weren't. But the thing that changed with the team when Lou came on board, and although the record hasn't necessarily been substantially better than it was under Blatt, is they are utilizing their players better, specifically Kevin Love. Blatt had no idea how to use Kevin Love. And as soon as Lou came in, you saw Love getting more spot up threes. You saw him more on the high post as an offensive facilitator, taking a little bit of the heat off of LeBron and off of Kyrie.
The thing with Kyrie and Love, it's a bit of a yin and a yang. With LeBron, he's the ultimate facilitator. He's a 25 to 30 point per game guy. His rebounds and assists are always way up. Really, still a really good defensive player, even though I think he's taken a little bit of a dip. I think he's gained a little bit of weight. He's not as fast as he used to be, even though on the fast break, LeBron is still a fucking freight train. But when it comes to Irving and Love, they're, like I was saying, there's a yin and a yang. Like when Love gets a few more touches and feel like he's getting more involved, you see a little bit of the production dip down for Irving. We had heard some murmurs that Irving was a little bit unhappy in Cleveland. His numbers are still good at 19 points and 4.7 assists. He's a spectacular player visually. But for Love, wouldn't it be – if it means that Kyrie gets less production in order for Love to get more, do you feel like that's a needed risk?
I think it is because Love's a little more – bit more unique, and he stretches the floor and makes it easier ultimately on their shooters and on essentially LeBron's basically a power forward these days on the low post, and he's Love frees things up, and he's a lot harder. He has to keep the offense or the defense honest because he can hit that three. He can hit that mid-range jumper. He can pass very well for a big man.
Yeah, and don't forget J.R. Smith, J.R. Smith, super-duper flawed player. Let's not forget that, but he's an incredible three-point shooter.
I would love to have J.R. Smith on my team. He is flawed, but he plays hard. He makes dumb mistakes. He's a kind of a hothead. But I do enjoy his game, and I would love for him to be, a bench player someday for the Kings, honestly.
You look at the numbers across the board for Cleveland from the team numbers, points per game, field goal percentage, even on the defensive end, even when they made the change from David Blatt, who I felt like was kind of one of the guys that really helped out their defense, especially if you watch them play the Warriors in the finals. Their defense was actually very, very good against them, probably better than any other team that played against them in that postseason. But so their points allowed, their rebounding, obviously, with Tristan Thompson, Timothy Mozgov, who's had a down year, LeBron, like we were talking about, Kevin Love still averages very close to a double-double. His rebounding average is 9.8. And then the offensive efficiency, the defensive efficiency, and they're all in the top 10. And the other thing that really sets them apart, and you hit the nail on the head, it's the threes. Even though they play at an incredibly slow pace, and there was that one little thing that was thrown out there that they give to every new coach. So when Tyronn Lue got the job, it was like, oh, we're going to play faster. Well, they still were 28th in pace. So how much faster did you get? But they still are a really, really efficient three-point shooting team. Do you think that's sort of one of the things that really sets them apart from a lot of the other Eastern Conference teams, is their efficiency at the three-point line?
I think so. I mean, I know Boston eventually, and I am predicting Boston to go all the way to the conference finals. I think I think they're going to beat Atlanta. I think they're going to beat Indiana. I think if it lines up that way.
Well, Boston plays Atlanta, they would wind up playing Cleveland.
That's it.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So yeah, they would. They aren't going to get it. They would be the second round matchup,
which would be very, very tough. Still,
that'd be a tough. It would be, but Boston's. Boy, we'll talk about Boston later. I think that's the stat that will help the Cavaliers kind of coast through for the most part to the NBA Finals is they're so well balanced. LeBron can score down low. Love can score up top. Kyrie can penetrate and kick it out, and or even penetrate and score pretty well. Although, you know, this year I think he's struggled not being the man. I think if things don't work out for them in the finals, or if they are swept by Golden State, I think Kyrie will be the next one to go.
Okay, you mean in terms of just being shipped?
Because their
payroll is at over $100 million. They're the only team that has that. Now, in the Capageddon that we're going to be having in the summer, we don't even know what that means because all these teams are going to be at the $95 million mark in terms of cap, and anybody can spend more than about $15 to $14 million. Extra cap room in order to get big names, whereas Cleveland's already taken that next step, and they don't really have a lot of room. So
but it would make
sense for a big contract like that to be shipped if they had to do it.
If a player can opt out, though, they're going to opt out this year, unless their production's way down and there's no chance. But even guys who've had so-so years, there's not a ton of free agents out there. So, you know, if you opt out and you have a shot at getting that big balloon thing that's going to hit the cap this year, I would do it. I think they're all going
to
do it.
Okay, you said that Cleveland is likely in a mode where they might be able to coast, but if they do coast, they would have to easily beat a Detroit Pistons team that has not been in the NBA playoffs since 2009. The team that actually embarrassingly swept them that year was Cleveland. The Pistons were really like LeBron's first bugaboo in the playoffs when he first got in. The team that eliminated him the first time he was in the playoffs in 06 was Detroit. And then they played in 07, and then they had that, you know, that great game where LeBron went nuts in game 5. And that was way, way long ago with the Detroit Pistons, you know, with the late Flip Saunders coaching that team. They had Billups and Prince and Rasheed Wallace and whatnot. But we have a brand new Pistons team. A lot has changed. Stan Van Gundy's the new head coach. And you've got Reggie Jackson, Andre Drummond, who is just a rebounding machine, absolute beast on the boards. Tobias Harris, who came in on a trade. He's played 25 games, but he's been incredibly effective. He's kind of filled in at the starting spot that Ersan Ilyasova had before the trade. Marcus Morris, who I always mix up with Markieff. I can never keep him apart. And then there's Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. Have you watched much of the Detroit Pistons? And if so, do you feel like this is a very, very different Detroit team from the teams of the past?
Well, I think with Drummond, you're always going to have that presence in the middle, that rim protector. You're always going to be a strong defensive team. And Van Gundy's a very good defensive coach. I think they are still finding their way, though. They are
a work in progress. I mean, they made the trade for Tobias, and then 2 games later, Anthony Davis had the infamous 59 right. and 20 game, you know?
Right on him, yeah.
Yeah.
Boy, looking at this roster, wow. Is Jennings injured or is
Jennings got shipped in the trade that was part of Tobias Harris. So he's gone. Yeah. It was Ersan and Jennings who did get hurt at Orlando for Tobias. And Tobias has played well, and they got him sealed through 2019. You know, Reggie Jackson was a walking punchline about, you know, people who got overpaid because he got about $15 to $16 million per year for about 3 or 4 years on his deal. But he's played incredibly well. You know, I would almost say over his head, you know, in the regular season this year. But is that going to translate against the Cleveland Cavaliers is really the big question here.
No, of course not. I think Drummond is going to be the only trouble spot, and Cleveland's a good enough outside shooting team. They may not even have to deal with Drummond in that aspect. And they're a well-oiled transition game, too, even whether their pace isn't so great. But Drummond is very athletic as a big guy, and he's, to me, the only position advantage one-on-one that Detroit has over Cleveland.
Drummond defensively definitely has problems. Like, when you look at the – you know, Kevin Love had this problem in Minnesota where you look at the rebounding numbers and you look at the double-doubles and you say, oh, what a great defensive player. But that's not always – it doesn't always compute that way. And no. I feel the same way with Drummond. Like, he's – truly a great rebounding machine type of player. You know, when you average 15 rebounds a game nearly in an 82 game season, I mean, that's incredible.
That's nuts, yeah.
But, you know, and he does average 1.5 steals. But, you know, I feel like if you can get Mozgov in there, get Tristan Thompson in there to try to surround him on, you know, to try to get offensive rebounds, get some like some kickouts or tip-ins, and then you can bring Love in to stretch. If Tobias Harris has trouble chasing around Love, then they might have to switch Drummond on him. Drummond's not a guy that's going to leave the paint. So there's going to be a lot of problems there matchup-wise for Detroit. However, the last time Stan Van Gundy matched up against LeBron James when he was in Orlando, albeit with a much better team at the time, Orlando pulled off the big upset. You don't see this at all?
I see maybe Detroit getting that first Detroit game just on the strength of Van Gundy's schemes, Van Gundy's in-game adjustments. He's a better, more experienced coach, and he is an excellent coach, and he can maximize what he's got with his players, but just Detroit doesn't have the depth. They don't have the athleticism to be in the same thing. It's a classic 8-1, you know, one versus eight matchup. It's going to be Cleveland either 4-0 or 4-1.
Yeah, it's a typical get your feet wet game or series for Detroit. You know, every team that's on the way up has that kind of series where they get embarrassed, they lose in four or five games, but at least you got some kind of experience in the playoffs where the players finally realize, okay, this is what it's going to take. You know, the Pelicans got that last year. Unfortunately, it didn't translate into the next season, but you know, and we might see a repeat of this over and over again on these playoff reviews, but I just don't really see much here. And because it's a 1-8 and we've seen eights beat ones, I just don't see it here. It's just not
this one. No,
it's just not possible. Let's move on over to the two versus the seven matchup. And to call the Indiana Pacers a seven seed just sounds weird because you're so used to them being a consistently successful team. But this is the first time that they're back in the playoffs since 2014. Obviously, they had the season in 2015 where Paul George missed like 99% of the season because of the broken leg. They played well. Their defense was good, but they still missed the playoffs. Then they kind of changed things. Roy Hibbert was shipped. David West went to San Antonio. And now you've got a little bit of a different team here, even though Paul George has bounced back very, very nicely as, you know, the star forward and the star player. There was obviously no yips for him when he came back from injury. Do you see much difference here with the Indiana Pacers, or do you feel like it's sort of the same team with just different players in the same uniforms?
The difference is their depth is not as good with guys with like Lance gone, and frontline strength of Hibbert, who is not an amazing player, but he's certainly better than what they've got at the center position at this point, or at least when he was at his peak.
Yeah.
I really like the addition of Ellis, though. I think Ellis is a supremely talented shooter and scorer. Average league defender, but he's a little undersized. I enjoyed watching Ellis in Golden State and Dallas too, and Kings made a serious run at him this year. But he's there at this point to take a little bit of the burden away from Paul George. And George Hill's an excellent point guard. He's an underrated point guard, even with his crazy white hair.
Yeah, with the Cisco.
yeah, Cisco. I've enjoyed watching him even back in the days as a Spur. So Pacers do not seem like a typical seven seed, but they're rebuilding, but it's a smart rebuilding where they kept their superstar and then they're building complementary players around him. I think Ellis is actually a pretty nice fit compared to Paul.
Yeah, you talked about how Stan Van Gundy's not the greatest coach of all time, obviously, but he's clever. I feel the sort of the same way about Frank Vogel. I think defensively, he's pretty smart. I think he has a really good idea of what his team is made of. You know, their defense obviously dipped from the Hibbert and West years and the, you know, even Lance Stephenson, who could get triple doubles every now and then. Who, you know, they were a little bit more multitask. They had a little bit more athleticism in the front court. Whereas now they kind of had to makeshift a little bit. They got a little bit lighter, a little more finessey. Their pace is much higher than they were in the past, but their offense is still fairly inefficient, to say the least. Defensively, still very good, even though the pace has picked up. They're eighth in points allowed. They're third in efficiency. They're one of the best teams in the league at steals. Paul George getting to the free throw line so much and being such a good three-point shooter has helped them. I also like the addition they had of Miles Turner as a rookie. Even though he didn't have the greatest numbers, he was at double-digit scoring and he averaged like 1.4 blocks, which for a rookie is like a godsend. You know, to get that out of a rookie is fantastic. The team team they're going to be going up against, because they are the seventh seed, they are the team that's going to be kind of be hunted for the top team, is going to be the Toronto Raptors. Number one, are you surprised that the Raptors are here at the two seed?
No, they've been consistent in building over the past couple of years. DeRozan and Lowry are very strong. Are they both on the last year of their deals? Is that correct?
DeRozan has a player option, which is at $9 million, which absolutely guarantees he will opt out. But
yeah,
Kyle Lowry is in for at least another year.
Okay. Although they're not the deepest team, I did get to see Toronto play in person. I was somewhat impressed. I thought they were Biombo's a nice athletic presence inside, and Kyle Lowry, though, was a star. And DeRozan's an excellent scorer, but Lowry as a point guard is very solid. I think defensively they're underrated. I think they're actually a little bit better than people give them credit for, although their depth on the bench, like Scola and Pat Patterson.
Bismack Biombo.
Yeah. Yeah, and boy, they've got a lot of former Kings on that roster. That's pretty crazy.
Jason Thompson is sitting there. Is that Jason Thompson? Yeah, he was cut by the Warriors.
Warriors to bring in Anderson. Yeah,
Andy Varejao, exactly. So there's Thompson sitting there with the Raptors, and yeah, a lot of interesting names there. Terrence Ross has sort of picked up a little bit because they needed him to, because Damari Carroll, even though he's been a really good pickup in free agency for the Raptors, he's been a good starter there. He's had injury issues, so they had to get a little bit more out of T. Ross than they normally did. Corey Joseph is a dependable backup point guard when Lowry needs a blow. A lot of people talk about he's in the best shape of his career thing going into a season, and people kind of like scoff at it, but it really feels like Kyle Lowry's in the best shape of his career, and he's playing at a high, high level.
Yeah, he dominated the Kings when I saw them. He was by far the most talented player, at least the backcourt player in the game when I saw him play against the Kings. Like I said, they're an underrated defensive team. They're a well-coached team. But they just don't seem to have the athleticism on the bench. And I think it could hurt them ultimately when they play Cleveland, obviously. But at this point, I think it's going to be a pretty close matchup with the Pacers. The things that the Pacers do well, they have a little bit more depth than Toronto does, I think, especially when you get those slower front court players in for Toronto. Scola is so slow at this point. It's going to be interesting to see what happens when that second unit is in for Toronto.
It feels like the Raptors have a little more athleticism in their bench, but I can see where the Pacers can take advantage of them playing big. The other thing that the Raptors have a problem, though, with is that they do have the monkey on their back. Just the figure.
Last year, yeah.
Yeah, the figurative. Not just that, the Nets, in 2014, where they went 7 games, they couldn't close it out at home. And the biggest storyline is that in the home games where they hosted those series, game one, they lost both times, and they were both Saturday games where they were like one of the first games up. They lost both games in the North. So,
it was Boston last year, right?
It was Brooklyn in 2014, and it was Washington.
Washington was
wound up sweeping them. Lowry had a miserably bad series.
That's right.
So we'll see here with Lowry and DeRozan. They were a great 1-2 punch. They were able to play on the All-Star team last year. This year, in Toronto, which was really nice for them. But the usage rate for DeRozan and Lowry is very, very high, meaning that their assists are very, very low. They don't really move the ball around much. They depend a lot on DeRozan to attack and get to the free throw line, which he's really great at. He's like one of the three or four best players in the league, or one of the top four players in free throws made. And then there's Lowry, who, even though he can dish it out, he averages six assists a game. His real strength is when he goes on the attack. So what we're seeing here is we've got basically 2 versus 1. You've got DeRozan and Lowry versus George. And I hate to simplify it into that for some of these NBA playoff matchups, because there's so many more things that you have to factor in with coaching and adjustments. But really, I mean, these are superstar-driven situations in the playoffs. I mean, do you think 2 versus 1 will be enough for Toronto in this case?
Well, I think it is ultimately going to come down to that, but the playoffs, things slow down a little bit. Talent shines through a little bit. And although Toronto has the two stars, Indiana has George, and I think he's ultimately going to be the best and best player in this series, in my opinion. I don't think Indiana's going to upset Toronto by any means, but I think Paul George is going to have an advantage by far over the front court players of Toronto.
do you see this going beyond five games?
I think it could go six games.
Okay.
In my opinion.
But you won't say seven. Like, you would say
I won't say seven. It's not going to be like last year, or not last year, but I think Toronto has the consistency. They've been there before, and the fans are just are ready.
The thing that's so going to be so important is, to me, is going to be those first two games. If Toronto wins those first two games at home, they are going to feel so good about themselves that I can almost see them having a letdown in Indiana, and they don't care because they're going to go right back home and they're going to start banking on the idea that they've kind of gotten that roadblock out of the way, and now that they can keep on going and start winning at home in the playoffs when it was such a problem for them in the previous years, they're going to get a lot more confidence, which is really a big, big thing. I mean, I hate to say that, you know, playoff games are sort of like morale boosters, you know, confidence boosters, because these are all incredibly important games for these teams. But for Toronto as a two seed, you know, I think that these first two games are going to be huge for them, huge for them. You know, the other thing with the Raptors, they don't play fast. They're like 29th in pace. So, you know, their three-point shooting is decent. You know, they shoot the ball from three better than they actually take attempts. You know, they don't really just go all the way from three. They got a lot of bigs there, like you were saying, with Valanciunas and Scola and even Patrick Patterson and James Johnson. So they don't rely as much on the three-pointer as – and not even – and Indiana doesn't either. So in terms of that, that might be like a decent little matchup. But I just have a problem with seeing Paul George – being able to carry that Indiana team against Toronto. It really depends on how much confidence, like I said, Toronto gets in those first two games. That's going to be pivotal.
I think if they let Monte run a little bit free, because Monte is an extremely talented offensive player.
Monte have it all.
Yeah. And do you know who Indiana's backup point guard is?
Well, George Hill and Monte Ellis Vogel likes to run them together. The right. Other guy that they like to play a lot is Rodney Stuckey.
Do you think, even though it's only been 13 games, Ty Lawson can make an impact for them?
Man, I you know, he's at 4.4 assists per game in 13 games with Indiana, but
in 18 minutes, that's pretty good.
Like, do you see are you looking at Ty Lawson sort of as like a surprise X factor?
Yeah, I think you go a little bit you tighten up the rotations in the playoffs, and you look at the matchups, Ty Lawson's maybe a little bit inferior defender to George Hill, but he's an explosive point guard, and you know, who knows if he's got his personal problems all worked out. It didn't certainly help him in Houston.
He can explode in all the wrong ways.
That's yeah.
The you know, and then you got Mahinmi in there, and you got all the Hillses. You got George Hill, Jordan Hill, Solomon Hill, maybe Faith Hill. Faith Hill may have played on that team. Lawson's weird. Like, I literally was doing research for these previews, and I realized Ty Lawson was playing for this team.
I had no idea.
I knew that Rockets had waived him. You know, he had the drunken issues, but I didn't realize he was at Indiana. So we'll see there. I mean, C.J. Miles is another – that's another big one. It'll be C.J. Miles at the forward spot against Patrick Patterson, who's been a really good sixth man for them. But he's going to get challenged by Miles. It's going to be a really there's a lot of intriguing matchups there. There's a little – and there's a nice little pinch of star power. It also gets the tag of the NBA TV series because they actually have two of their first four games on NBA TV. And that always gives you the notion that the NBA schedule makers think that that's the series that people will care the least about.
Yeah. And Toronto's not technically a smaller market, but Indiana is. It is. That explains
it. So in terms of like demographics, I guess it makes sense. You want the Cleveland games, you want the LeBron games, you want pretty much all of those Western Conference games with the exception of maybe San Antonio. But just because of marketing reasons, not because of style of play.
Right.
But let's go ahead and move on to the Miami Heat and the Charlotte Hornets, you know, and I got so many problems with the fact that they're called the Hornets, and they want to go back to their own history as the Hornets, where they were Charlotte, and then New Orleans, and then they became the Pelicans, and then they took back the Hornets, and my brain's about to explode. So now people are giving the idea that the Charlotte Hornets have had that success in the NBA playoffs in the past because, well, they're the Hornets. But the truth is, and let's really bear it down, I do not care what the historians say, these Charlotte Hornets have never won a playoff game.
These are the Bobcats. They are the Bobcats now. They were the Bobcats then. Kemba Walker is still a Bobcat, but
now you're a 90s guy. So are you happy that the teal is back?
I love the teal purple combo, baby. I love that pinstripe look too. I was a big LJ fan. I was a big Muggsy Bogues fan. I enjoyed Charlotte quite a bit back in the day.
Yeah. Now, obviously, you're talking about, you know, the Charlotte Hornets back in the day when even then, you know, they were successful, a little more successful than people think, but also, you know, had they didn't last as long as people thought they did. It's kind of like the, you know, they just did that for 30 for 30 about the Orlando Magic, and the telltale of that and the Golden State Warriors when they were run TMC is that just to throw it back, the Kings in the early 2000s, is that as great as it feels like it is, it doesn't last as long as you think.
No, it's a 3 or 4 year window.
Yeah.
And boy, it seems like they're eternal. You know, those teams lasted forever, but there was only 2 or 3 years. It's like the Knicks in the early 90s.
Yeah.
They were gone in a hurry. As soon as, you know, if somebody gets old, somebody gets injured, everything changes. Well, look at the Pacers now. The Pacers were perennially up there. And then, you know, when Paul George gets hurt, and they're on their way back up, we think.
And so for the Hornets, what do you feel like about this incarnation of the Charlotte Hornets? Now, they've been in the playoffs before, you know, when they were the Bobcats. One time they were – well, twice as the Bobcats, they were in the playoffs. There was the 1 year where they had Raymond Felton and Tyson Chandler, and they got swept by the Magic. Then in 2014, they got in there with Al Jefferson as the star player. Along, you know, Kemba Walker was just learning how to be a point guard. They got swept badly by the heel big three NWO of Miami Heat. And so now we've got – this Charlotte Hornets team that has Kemba Walker sort of taken the crown as the star player on that team. They've made a few changes, but how do you feel about this Hornets team?
I saw them in person as well, and I thought they were very well disciplined. I thought their turnovers were kept to a minimum. They were a good team, move the ball, find the open player team, great team defense. And I love Jeremy Lin. He's one of my guilty pleasures as an NBA fan because I think he's not very athletic, but he's always entertaining to watch, and he will do something that blows you away, surprises you, kind of out of nowhere.
What hair did he have?
He had the what do you call it? It was spiky.
What do you call it is the name of all the hairstyles.
and their front court's a little slow. As far as, you know, Jefferson's a good low post.
I made this prediction to start the season, and I almost, once he got the marijuana violation, I was kind of feeling good about it. I think this is it for Al Jefferson. I think as an unrestricted free agent going into the summer, I think he's going to retire. You know, he's at 12 points, 6 rebounds, played 47 games, but you're right. He is definitely taking a step down. Marvin Williams actually has kind of stepped up, so that's sort of helped kind of catch back on what they were missing from Al Jefferson's, you know, drop in play, and also the fact that he missed a lot of games due to suspension. The other guy for the Hornets who's really stunned me in how well he's played is Nick Batum.
Yeah, what a great pickup from Portland. Batum was always up there, but it's interesting because he was just kind of in Portland. They were always competitive, but he goes to Charlotte and thrives, and CJ McCollum picks up where Batum left off, and Matthews too, Wes Matthews leaving.
Yeah.
And so Batum, he played more of a small forward.
Yeah, he's almost like a point forward almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But here he's playing more of the two, and you know, he's a complete player. He's a good offensive and a good defensive player. Excellent passer for his position. And I've always enjoyed him too, but he's kind of surprised me having an opportunity to play in a different situation. He might be the second most athletic player on that team next to Walker.
Walker had a 50 point game. He had a couple of 40 point games, I believe, too. Very explosive. Everybody obviously saw how well he could play in clutch situations when he was at UConn. But that's college. You know, obviously Frank Kaminsky was a great player in college. He's playing on this Hornets team, and as a rookie, so. You know, Jeremy Lamb was even on that team, and you know he's played well. He got a contract extension in Charlotte, but he's not a spectacular player. They made a couple of additions in the middle of the season. They got Courtney Lee.
In that
three-way deal. Jeremy Lin, like you were saying, in the offseason. Troy Daniels, who's a really good three-point shooter that just everyone always forgets about. They have a little bit more depth than people think. I think people forget about their depth because they're not super duper athletic, you know, which is like code word for they have a lot of white guys on the bench.
Yeah.
But
hey, Tyler Hansbro, one of my least favorite NBA players and NCAA players of all time.
You know, they got Hansbro. Let me count them. Kaminsky, Hawes, Hansbro, and Cody Zeller. I mean, that has to like break that's got to break a code, right?
Well, you know, we used to razz on Boston and Utah for having a lot of white guys, and nobody kind of batted an eye, but there's
Nick Batum is French, so does that count?
It does not count. He's not white.
Oh, shit. All right, and then so defensively, like you were saying, very good. Steve Clifford, that is his thing. That's what he likes to do. So they were ninth in points allowed. They were ninth in defensive efficiency. That's pretty even. You hit the nail on the head with the how careful they are with the ball. Turnovers, they're first. They don't give up the ball ever. The one thing that changed big time with Charlotte is three-point shooting. They were like the dirt worst for like the last two or three years in three-point shooting. This year, they really picked it up. They focused on it. They've given a lot of liberties to guys like, you know, Marvin Williams and Jeremy Lin and Nick Batum and Kemba Walker to launch away. Their three-point percentage is eighth in the league, but they were third in points made. They get to the free throw line a lot, which means that they attack, even though they're kind of a small ball team. They, outside of Jefferson's big, you know, big butt, they don't really have a lot of true big guys. The team they're going to be facing is the Miami Heat. The Miami Heat have home court advantage here as the three seed, but they're going to be playing without Chris Bosh. It's pretty, we were kind of assuming that anyway with the reoccurrence of the blood clots, but it's definite now that he is not going to be there in the playoffs. But even, let me say this though, Todd, even without Chris Bosh, this is still a very good team.
You have Dwayne Wade, who's been there a lot. He's been in the playoffs almost every season of his career, has he not?
Yes.
I don't know. I'm trying to think. And I mean, just so as far as coming to the game, being the man, when the bright lights are on, Dwayne Wade has stepped up. My wife's favorite NBA player, by the way. I don't know why. Anyway, the additions of Joe Johnson in the backcourt, that's an interesting, interesting fit.
Joe Johnson, to my shock, has actually been a really good infusion for them. Gives him a three-point shooter, gives him a little bit more danger at the perimeter.
And Stoudemire, too. I mean, you just have a little bit more depth. They seem old. They may be the oldest team in the league. Is that right?
Their experience is second in the league. Their experience rate is second in the league behind the Spurs. The Spurs are the oldest. The Spurs actually gained a year in experience by getting Andre Miller. That's how old Andre Miller is. Former King, wow. I believe.
Yeah, former King, George Karl's boy. I think Andre Miller is going to be a hell of a coach someday, actually. He's a really good point guard. He's actually from, or he has a house in the Sacramento area. So he was on the team for a half a year last year, replaced Ramon Sessions, and he was really liked in the community, but we thought we were going to pick him up for a minimum deal. Minnesota got him, and then he ends up on the Spurs along with Kevin Martin. The West is so loaded. Yeah.
So the Spurs are the Game of Thrones of the NBA in terms of seniority. But with the Heat, they're right behind them. A little bit of age there, obviously, still with Luol Deng, Joe Johnson, Goran Dragic has been around the block. They do have some young pups there. Hassan Whiteside
and Winslow,
Justice Winslow and Josh Richardson. Yeah, just a lot of good rookies or young guys that can kind of mix up with the really, really old veterans that they had. Like you said, Josh McRoberts, Amari Stoudemire. Obviously, they're first in blocks in the league. That's thanks almost all in part because of Whiteside.
Whiteside.
What do you think? And he's a former King, too, kind of seeing the craps under Keith Smart. What do you think of Whiteside?
I think he is a very athletic defender. I think his upside is still yet to be found. But I think as opposed to Boogie, who has a lot more offensive game, Whiteside is primarily, he might be a DeAndre Jordan of the team.
He is all paint. He is all cylinder. If he goes five feet away from the cylinder, I would be shocked.
He is a free agent, and he is going to command quite. Somebody's going to just go, oh, I've got to give that kid a max deal, and you know, we'll see what happens. But to rely on him so heavily is pretty scary. I think.
Yeah. And, you know, and I felt like Bosch was a really nice compliment with what Whiteside does, because Bosch is still a good rebounder. He had an all-star caliber year before the blood clot issue came up, but he was averaging 19 points, really good three-point shooter now. You know, I would almost make the argument he is probably deserving of the $23 million per year he makes. And now with the new money, it probably might, he probably be even more deserving of more, because that might go up to like $29 million per year as a max player, depending on where the scale goes. But I think Bosch has played so well, but we're obviously going to have to subtract him here. We look at the matchup here with the Hornets, and, you know, points per game, they're 23rd. Obviously, the Hornets have the advantage there. Field goal percentage is interesting, because even though the Hornets shoot the ball well from the three-point line, their two-point efficiency is god-awful. They were 27th in field goal percentage. Miami, while they don't take a lot of threes, they were 27th in the league in three-pointers made. They were 4th in field goal percentage. They don't make a lot of mistakes. So what do you feel is going to be the tipping point here between Miami and Charlotte?
The experience of Miami versus the discipline and the youth and athleticism of Charlotte, which sometimes goes away in the playoffs. The game slows down. I think it depends on how healthy Wade stays, because Wade is going to be the usage guy for Miami on offense. And so the ball is going to go through him. Dragic is okay. He's a good player. But they don't move the ball a whole lot around. You know, nobody has a ton of rebound of assists, especially with Bosch out of there. He's such a good passer from the high post. But I think it will come down to Johnson hitting threes, but I'm still going to pick Charlotte in a 7-game upset, honestly.
Ooh, okay. So you see the lower seed, the road team stealing it here.
They've never won a playoff game, which means they've never won a playoff series.
But neither did the Grizzlies in 2011, and they upset the Spurs.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the intangibles, Charlotte's got a lot of momentum. This is their best year as a franchise, I think. I believe so, anyway.
Well, depending on, like we were saying, depending on how you, like, curtail all the other histories and you link them all together. It's like that old Sonic Thunder debate that you always have. But in terms of the franchise, yes, this was the best season that they've had.
The Bobcats / Hornets 2.0.
This is by far the best year that they've had.
And MJ's got a lot of everybody's kind of turned their attention back to MJ with these crying MJ memes and Kobe retiring, and we remembering how much better and more efficient Michael Jordan was as a leader and a player compared to Kobe Bryant.
Is it sad when you look, because I know you're on Twitter, is it sad when you look at him, people don't realize who Michael Jordan is?
There are people like, why is that guy with the big head crying? What's going on with that? It is sad. I mean, Michael Jordan was the dominant athlete of my lifetime, I think.
Like, when he was in the stands for the national title game, people were like, hey, that's the crying guy. I'm like, dude, that's fucking Michael Jordan, the greatest basketball player of all time.
That's Skyman. That's the guy. That's the logo.
And the other thing about the Heat and the Hornets, and you can definitely show me the vast difference, or give me a telltale of the vast difference here, because, you know, the Kings were one of the, like, I think they were the only team that played faster than the Golden State Warriors, even though the efficiency was, but it doesn't matter. The fact is, games were super duper up and down in Sacramento. You know, high scoring, 102 points per game was the scoring average in the NBA. It's almost like the scoring bubble has, like, fucking exploded in the NBA. Even though it doesn't necessarily mean you have great basketball, it just means you have, like, a lot more crazy numbers being thrown at you when it comes to, like, scoring outputs. But for the Heat and the Hornets, it's going to definitely be, like you said, a slow them down game. You know, neither team plays fast. They're defensively predicated, for sure. Still under Eric Spoelstra, they were still 4th in points allowed. We mentioned that Charlotte was at 9. So there's definitely going to be – it's going to be a little bit of a throwback. I mean, are you sort of looking forward to seeing a game where things go back to where things are in the 80s and, you know, the games are super duper slow and super tight?
If this series gets to 7 and it goes to Miami for game 7, it could get really bloody. It could get pretty intense. It's just everything slowing down. I think you could be in for quite a, it'd be like watching the Spurs versus the, maybe the, I'm trying to think of another slowed down team. You know, I think
it would be like the Spurs and the Grizzlies, which we're going to be seeing.
Yeah, there you go. That's it. Well, guess what? We're going to see. I think we're going to see a sweep in that series, unfortunately.
Oh, you might see a lot of sweeps in the West.
I mean, the West is surprising. You know, we have the top four, and then it drops off dramatically for the bottom four of the West.
Yeah, Broomstock is way up in the Western Conference. But, I mean, you know what? That's a really good aside. We'll just tackle this really, really quick before we move away from this series, which you predicted that the Hornets would go.
I do. I think if it happens, they will win in seven. It'll be a dogfight. I also look for Dwayne Wade to get hurt. Halfway through the series, being in the game.
Are you saying that you want him to get hurt, or you just think he will?
I'm not looking for it. Gabrielle, I didn't mean that, honey.
do you mean the wife? What's your wife's name?
Corey.
Okay, so I thought Gabrielle was your wife, which is like, no, okay, that's Dwayne Wade. It makes sense why she likes Dwayne Wade.
Dwayne Wade's wife is Gabrielle Union. So I didn't say he's going to get hurt. I'm not, you know, giving him a curse, but I think he's been here so many times. He's so old, and he's the same from the same
thing about Wade too.
And
the other thing about Wade too is this: LeBron went to the playoffs obviously when he joined Cleveland. And he left Miami. Bosh and Wade didn't get their chance yet because they missed the playoffs last year. So this is the chance for Wade in the playoffs. Now, obviously, if he wants to play against LeBron in the playoffs, they'll have to do it in the conference finals. He would have to win this one and beat the winner of the Toronto Indiana series to get there if Cleveland is even there. But for Dwayne Wade, do you feel like there's a little bit of showmanship here with LeBron where he obviously has shown it throughout the regular season this year where he stayed healthy. He's in much better shape. His efficiency is better than ever. It's almost like he's kind of like hit the fountain of youth somehow. But do you feel like Wade in the playoffs here is going to say, you know what, I can still fucking do this?
Yeah, I do. And I think because he's such a good scorer, he's such a good primetime player, he's deceptive that way. You know, the bright lights come on, Dwayne Wade steps up. He's never had a chance to be the guy. He was the guy kind of with Shaq when they won their first ring, and then he had to defer to LeBron for the next two.
Yeah.
But this is his golden moment. There is no other star on that team. There are good role players. There are good supporting players, but it's D-Wade's show. So if they do beat Charlotte, which I don't predict is going to happen, but if they do, it's going to be because Dwayne Wade was transcendent. Hopefully, if he does get there and he's got that matchup with LeBron on the horizon, hopefully he stays healthy. I've seen this too many times. Dwayne Wade gets overplayed and he gets hurt, and things fall apart.
Where they got, you know, Spoelstra's going to kind of have to manage it at the end so that he doesn't try to wear him out too much. Yeah. I've definitely seen that. I mean, we literally saw Wade in the Miami years when they were on top. I saw where they actually sat him for an entire game where they were sweeping the Bucks. Like, they literally sat him.
Yep.
You know,
the whole game.
And it was like, wow, this guy is really, like, time is definitely ticking on this guy, but he's kicked it up a notch a tad over the last season. We'll see there. You were in Sacramento, obviously, like we were talking. We talked about how the Kings were first in pace, which means that every team that stopped in that place knew, okay, we got to get our track shoes on, and you need to like sweat your palms out because we're gonna be racking up some points here, regardless of who's playing against us or who's gonna be on the court. But do you feel like that's bad basketball watching some of the offense, even though a lot of people are super excited at, you know, the Golden State Warriors and the fact that they're the bee's knees and everything is predicated on their shooting and how it's a copycat league, and now everybody wants to shoot threes just like the Warriors do. But do you feel like that lends itself to bad basketball, even though aesthetically it's a little more pleasing to the eye than these potentially ugly rock fights like Charlotte versus Miami?
Sorry, there's my mute button. Sorry about that. Adam Silver wants an up-tempo league, and up-tempo generally equals ratings. If you look at Golden State, there are kids watching basketball that have never, you know, they didn't relate to Miami. They didn't relate to the dominant teams before the Warriors. So look at Golden State, and there are kids who don't watch any other team all over the country idolizing Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. And so that's kind of what the model has been for Pace, but is that what's ultimately good for the league? Well, I don't know. You have teams like the Spurs and Miami who were kind of ground and pound to get it in there. So I don't know. I think the Kings, unfortunately, they were leaders in pace, but look at their efficiency. Look at Rondo's turnovers. He needs some idiotic passes. Look at their free throw percentage. It's one of the worst in the league. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, as often as Cousins got fouled and made it to the line, he only would make one or two a lot of the time. And that's just dumb. It's just stuff that is easily fixable.
What do you prefer? Like, what do you prefer watching him?
I like a balance. I do like it when you have the weave and players like Steph Curry that just can hit something out of nowhere. But I've also, you know, liked the battles that you saw the Lakers and the Celtics, where it was just slow and you were going to get every second of that shot clock used. I think there's a balance. I think the regular season is for pace and the playoffs are for possessions.
Now, you talk about balance, and that's a really good segue here, because we got two pretty well-balanced teams that are going to be in the 4-5 matchup. The 4-5 in the playoffs in each conference is always a really interesting one, because it means you've got two teams that are not only record-wise, but in terms of closeness and talent, it's always like right there. You're not really sure. That's why it's a 4-5. Even though some of them can become incredibly one-sided and make you feel like a dumbass, like maybe a month later when you were trying to predict it and then you realize something, it went totally the other way. But this one is going to be really fascinating. That's the Atlanta Hawks versus the Boston Celtics. Balance is definitely the name of the game for both these teams, but especially with Atlanta. Atlanta had a great year last year. I actually believe they overachieved. They were 60-22. They got to the conference finals, hit a lot of snags with injuries, and just got embarrassed by, you know, a much more talented Cleveland Cavaliers team. But the Hawks, when you look at the record, they won about 50 games. That did almost 12 games worse or actually 14 games worse than they did last season. But do you feel like Atlanta, in some ways, have actually gotten a little better than they were last year?
Well, does that speak to Atlanta staying put and just being consistent, or have the other teams in the East kind of stepped up a little bit and become a little more competitive? I think with the better performances of teams like Toronto and Charlotte and Miami surprising everybody by stepping up to the three, Atlanta seems like they're exactly the same team as last year. I know that that's not technically the case, but
they literally are the exact same.
They are the same
only
team.
The only difference is DeMarre Carroll's not there, so they put in Kent Bazemore.
Yeah, and that's kind of a push. Carroll's, I think, on the way up, and he's found a good fit in Toronto.
Yeah.
But the other difference to me is that Korver is not shooting as well as he did last year. I think teams have had enough time to adjust to seeing how they the Hawks, as the Spurs 2.0, right?
That's kind of what the Spurs of the East, like. Yeah, under Coach Bud.
So I think they've kind of shut down Korver a little bit, and he was the guy that helped the Hawks, a couple extra points last year, a couple extra, 3 points per game. You'd have a few more threes shot. They look exactly the same. And Teague, I'm surprised he wasn't traded. They shopped Teague all over the league, and they didn't move him. Schroeder. Is it Schroeder or Schrader?
It's Schroeder. Dennis Schroeder.
Okay.
It's German.
Hey, Nick Duke, this is my shout-out. I think Schroeder is going to be the starting point guard in Atlanta next year.
It's German for Rondo.
Rondo's a good passer, a good distributor of the ball, but his discipline is lacking. And he's a weirdo. Rondo's bizarre dude. Having watched him up close, and he likes to troll. He likes to... he didn't have any real public blow-ups with Carl, but he wouldn't be in the huddle half the time. He'd just kind of be, all right, I know what's going on. I got my play. And he's going to run the play he wanted to run regardless, whether the ball ends up 2 feet over Rudy Gay's head or what. But
decent depth here with Atlanta. You were alluding to the fact that they had some ideas of trades in the case they had to blow it up. Al Horford's a free agent. They were kind of looking for moves there. It didn't happen. Jeff Teague, he's going into the last year of his contract at $8 million a year. Tried to move him. Didn't happen. They were able to get a little bit more out of Dennis Schroeder there, even though Jeff Teague still played really, really well down the stretch. Paul Millsap defensively had an excellent year. He's at 1.8 steals, 1.7 blocks, nine rebounds, which is very close to his career mark, if not his career mark as a rebounder. Just a really good year for him. He sort of ascended himself as, the best player that Atlanta has. their big key last year was their balance. Like, they don't have a star player. Their star player is them, you know, their unity. Well, I feel like Millsap is definitely their best player this year. So there's a little bit more of a disproportionate balance in Atlanta in terms of their usage. Their assists are still second in the league. They share the ball great. That hasn't gone away. Like you said, their field goal percentage has dipped. They're middle of the pack in three-point percentage. They're 11th in field goal percentage. Now, 11th in field goal percentage, you know, bad teams would die to have that. But for Atlanta, that when they were like one of like the two or three best teams in the league at field goal percentage, that's definitely a little alarming. Defensively, very good. Experience-wise, very good. So there's just, you know, their biggest weakness is obviously they are rebounding, where they're 25th. They turn the ball over a lot, and they don't ever get to the free throw line because – their biggest knock, obviously, when you watch them against Cleveland in the conference finals, just not a super athletic team.
Yeah, and again, it's so funny how consistent they were from last year, except maybe Millsap, like you said, stepped up a little bit. Hopefully, Cephalosha will stay not stabbed in these playoffs. I hope, as a closet fan of the Thunder, I enjoy his play, but you know, hopefully he will stay healthy. But I think Boston may be in a position to upend them. Although, to me, it feels like Atlanta's maybe more built for the playoffs, honestly. But Boston has this better coach, at least a more flashy coach, a more creative coach who maximizes his players. Atlanta feels, again, like Spurs 2.0, and there are situations that a team like that can get caught off guard, like against the Clippers last year.
The Hawks are the 4 seed, and they're going to be hosting, like you were saying, the Boston Celtics. They're not new here. They were in the playoffs last year. They got swept by Cleveland, even though they had that infamous Game 4 where J.R. Smith sucker punched Jay Crowder and Kelly Olynyk tried to take Kevin Love's arm off. So it's almost I wonder in a ways if Cleveland is sort of like kind of eyeing Boston, like, I hope we can get him just so that we can stick it back to him for costing us Kevin Love in the playoffs last year. But
that's right. That was dirty. That was dirty as heck.
I agree.
Boston is such a good 3-point shooting team. I think they're going to, as good as a defensive team and consistent defensive team as Atlanta is, that spreads the floor so much. When you have great Jay Crowder is such a good 3-point shooter from
he's a perfect 3-D guy, but he got a knee injury late and he hasn't played well since. So I'm wondering if we're going to get, you know, it's kind of like Lowry when he had some injury troubles late last year and he didn't look the same against the Wizards. So I kind of worry about that, but Avery Bradley, another good 3-D guy. Jared Sullinger has played better than I thought. Evan Turner, I don't know what happened to Evan Turner. Like, he just suddenly became a good player again. It was very strange.
He connected with a coach who knew, who was able to figure out what Evan Turner was good at doing. And honestly, Isaiah Thomas takes a lot of heat off of that shooting guard position. Thomas is a score first point guard. He always has been. And even though his assist numbers aren't bad, but you know, to be averaging 20-21, he's starting most of the games, actually all the games, it looks like. I'm so upset the Kings let him go for nothing, and that's why Pete D'Alessandro is the worst executive who's ever been in the NBA.
Well, not only that, the Suns did too.
The Suns got more for him than the Kings did. Kings got a draft free agent exemption or something like that.
Yeah, well,
they didn't get anything tangible.
Which is one of the 25 things they traded the Kings for nothing.
They traded to the Sixers
for nothing.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Nick Stauskas. When you look at the Celtics, I mean, you know, it's not like the sexiest team ever. Literally not sexy. You know, Kelly Olynyk, okay. And then you got Marcus Smart. He's like crazy. He's like almost crazy talented. Not like oh my god, he's so talented. It's like this. It's like Lance Stephenson. Like, this guy's really talented, but I have no idea what he's about to do, kind of thing.
Marcus Smart was from Oklahoma, right?
He was at Oklahoma State.
Oklahoma State, OSU, okay.
He was the one who got in the fight with the fan in the stands.
That's right.
Texas
State. That was crazy. That was really crazy. No, I watched him quite a bit, actually, on SportsCenter. I think he is very athletic and very good, but he's technically an undersized guard, too.
Yes.
And you know, you have a little bit more height and a little bit more discipline on Atlanta, but you have a better coach and maybe a more creative coach in Brad Stevens in Boston. And you have Isaiah Thomas who can go for 35, and you don't know. If Boston had lost to the Knicks and they were down 24 the other day, they would have finished up with the sixth seed.
Yeah, that was Miami, who a lot of people thought they were going to play again in the playoffs.
Boston I think Boston would have a clear advantage over Miami at this year.
Yeah.
Even you know, with the being a lower seed, they play fine on the road, but boy, it's going to be tough. I think Atlanta, this is another very competitive, very even as far as advantages. There's a couple advantages on one side because a couple advantages on the other side.
Do you think coaching is going to be huge here?
I think Brad Stevens, if he's able to get open threes for his guys and take away some of the low post play of Atlanta, especially from Horford, yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, because the Celtics are a little undersized too. They do have some tall guys like Kelly Olynyk. Amir Johnson's been a decent pickup there. He basically made David Lee expendable.
And Crowder plays almost like a four, like a stretch four.
Yeah, but it does, and that's true. But it does kind of expose them for small ball,
right?
You know, and for Atlanta, it's gonna be harder for them to take advantage of that. But Horford and Millsap, like you said, are so good at playing multiple positions while trying to sit there at the four. And remember too that Atlanta has Mike Scott, and when they put Mike Scott in there with Schroeder, they're actually highly efficient too. So if Atlanta's got to go big, they can do it and still be efficient. Whereas for the Celtics, Brad Stevens is a guy who can kind of morph his team into anything. You know, they went to Golden State, they had to play super fast, and they did it with no problem. They're third in pace, which is amazing.
What a classic game Boston at Golden State was.
Yeah, and then if they have to go a little slow and kind of, you know, try to muddy up the game a little bit, get to the free throw line, they can do that too. There's 11th in free throws made. They're 6th in free throw percentage, so if they have to make free throws down the stretch, they can make them. You know, it's a very balance, like we were saying at the top. Balance is a very, very big part of this, but the trick here is which team sort of cracks when you have to go to your adjustments. And I think coaching is huge here between Mike Budenholzer and Brad Stevens.
Boy, it's going to be close. I mean, you have the Popovich disciple versus the college wunderkind in...
I love John Wooden. I mean, I wasn't even alive when I was 7 years, not yet born, when he won his last national title. Mike Krzyzewski is great. You know, I give a lot of credit to a lot of other great college coaches. I have never seen a better coaching achievement in college than Brad Stevens getting Butler to the national title game 2 years in a row.
2 years in a row, this small school... Yeah, absolute genius to be able to do that against the Coach K's, against the Roy Williams of the NCAA. And, you know, they have such a good upside. They have all these draft picks, and if they trade them for a superstar or maybe somebody they think will fit pretty well, maybe Boogie Cousins, I don't know. That's been rumored for years.
And yeah, that's the one. And then
I don't know.
And then the Kevin Durant one is the one
we've heard
all the time.
No, Durant's going to the Lakers. You heard it here first. Did you hear Washington wants to hire Scott Brooks in the hopes that Kevin Durant will follow?
Well, it doesn't shock. I mean, Randy Whitman, his days were numbered the moment we found out. You know, it's actually good to talk about this because we're in the Eastern Conference, and one of the teams I was contending that a lot of people thought was going to be there was the Washington Wizards.
Yeah,
and it didn't happen.
Last year.
So when they didn't make it, and John Wall had some injuries, and Bradley Beal.
Beal dropped off tremendously. Yeah.
He had bad injuries really held him back, and you knew Whitman's days were numbered. So now you're thinking, okay, they're going to try to abide to, you know, a potential superstar by getting a guy that he likes, which is not exactly the first time I've ever heard this before. You know, I mean, this is marketing ploy 101 when it comes to courting free agents. You know, you're not trying to, like, you know, sucker the fans into going to the games. You're trying to sucker these players into signing with your team. You know, and with the free agency frenzy that's about to go down, it does kind of make sense if you want to do it. But boy, Scott Brooks was the worst. So if Kevin Durant, if Scotty Brooks being there is going to lure Kevin Durant, that is like that's like a dog wanting to eat garbage and getting in stuck into a cage, you know.
Man, I'm just gonna wait for the day that Scott Brooks coaches the Sacramento Kings back into the playoffs. Local boy, former assistant coach too. Was he Keith Smart or Paul Westphal's assistant coach? I don't know. He's a friend of a friend, so I can't think too badly about him. But if you have those two future Hall of Famers in Westbrook and Durant, and you only got to one final in all those years, Mm-hmm. You know, I think he's overmatched.
Yeah,
at this point.
And a little bit of wrong place, wrong time. You had the Miami peak years there, and then you had San Antonio, and then all of a sudden you have the supernova that is Golden State, and now there's nothing you can do. You know, it's like, it's a little early to say all these things regardless of, and we're not going to talk too much about the West, but, you know, we're going to do an overview prediction in a second on your side. But, like, for Golden State, I don't want to say that they're already there as like that championship dynasty, but I mean, Todd, we're getting really, really close to seeing a team where it's going to be, they're going to get at such a high level that it's going to take almost a, like the Kings in 02 when they, you know, they lost to the Lakers in 2000 and then they got swept badly by the Lakers in 2001. And then, and that was the year where the Lakers went on that crazy run where they only lost one game in the playoffs. And the Kings realized that year, okay, we got to fucking do it. We've got to really make a go for this. And that next year in 2002, they had like one of the best years ever.
Their regular season was so good that year. And then the playoffs were too. I on principle will not talk about, for fear of violating my parole, I will not talk about the 2002 Game 6 thing on here, but you can search my Twitter timeline.
Well, let's have our come to Jesus moment here with 2002. Are you over it yet?
I think Sacramento will never be over it until, and I am a part of Sacramento, I think we will never be over it until we actually get a ring, which could be a very, very long time. Our memories go back forever. This town is still idolizing guys like Vlade Peja, Doug Christie, Bobby Jackson, the sixth man of the year. He's now everywhere in town. Scott Pollard is on Survivor. This 2002 team.
Don't forget about Lawrence Funderburk.
No, we are forgetting about. He wrote a very nice book about not giving your posse all of your money. Did you
Lawrence Funderburk wrote a book?
He wrote a book about not giving, not wasting all your money. But Lawrence Funderburk was a cool guy, but he was a terrible NBA player.
And the point of that little dissertation about that '02, that great '02 Kings team is that you force teams to have to step up to where you're at. Do you feel like Golden State is almost at that point where you're looking at them like, all right, that's where we have to be?
Nobody. And Golden State at their best, there's nobody that's going to be able to touch them.
So it's so you're saying it's almost like the Bulls in the late 90s where it's almost unattainable.
Something bad, either an injury or some kind of major league breakdown, Draymond goes off his meds or something. Something's going to have to happen where Golden State beats themselves ultimately. As good as San Antonio is, we just saw San Antonio had everything to gain by this win, this game Sunday night, where they were going for the perfect home record, and Golden State, as beat up as they were these last four tough games, came back in the second half and took it to them. And it was kind of like, you know, when Golden State wants to, when they play smart, when Kerr makes the adjustments, nobody can beat them. And their depth is really good, believe it or not. You know, their bench is almost better than most teams starting five.
And being, you know, being in this, obviously divisions aren't as important anymore because, you know, conference standings are factored in now instead of divisional championships and such in the seasons and playoffs and blah, blah, blah. But still, it's Pacific Division. You've got a good look at these guys. What do you think of the Warriors in person?
They're really exciting to play. They are compelling personalities who are supremely talented.
What kind of vibe does Curry give live?
Curry is explosive, fast. You blink and you haven't had time to process everything. And I have actually never seen Curry in person. I watch him a lot because I'm up late watching him on TV.
They're in the Bay. Yeah.
But what happens when the Warriors come to town, all the Warriors fans who are kind of halfway between Sacramento and San Francisco can afford to gladly, you know, outbid Kings fans for their tickets. Although the Kings had pretty good attendance this year, when Golden State comes in, it's always a sellout, and it's always 40% Golden State fans, 60% Kings fans, and it just kind of irks me quite a bit.
Okay, and we're going to go ahead and move all this over, since just in the event that, and you know, I'm so glad that you came onto this show. It was so much fun having you. But we're going to just go ahead and kind of go through the gamut here with Todd Weber and see what he feels like with all of these matchups between the Western Conference, the Eastern Conference, and the finals. So, Todd Weber, give me your gauntlet.
The West, all the top seeds are going to advance, and then you will have Warriors Clippers. Yeah, Warriors Clippers. I think that's actually going to be a 5-game series. Warriors may lose one in LA to a rapidly aging Chris Paul, who had a really good year. Mm-hmm. Jamal Crawford's one of my favorite players, but who knows what's going on with the Blake situation? You know, will Blake come back? Blake Griffin was so controversial with his suspension, and the team seemed to play better without him for a long time.
Yeah, you know where he was at all the time? He was in the zone.
Yeah, he was in the zone. He was jumping over cars. I don't know what he was doing. But yeah, Blake Griffin's a weird cat, man. Strange dude.
What a dirty thing to punch a trainer in the face.
I'm thinking that trainer was. I'm not justifying.
He was probably macking on his girl.
Yeah, something was going on where that guy was feeling his oats and thinking he was more important than somebody who picks up the clothes when someone drops them. Basically, a glorified ball boy. but still.
So you like Golden State Clippers?
Golden State is going to beat the Clippers and advance to the conference finals. I think Oklahoma City and San Antonio will be a cleaner series. Maybe you will see a little bit of Durant and Westbrook's last hurrah, in my opinion. Well, I mean, they brought in Billy Donovan to coach them, and they seem to play pretty well, but we don't really know.
The Thunder have had a really good year, but man, San Antonio actually had their best regular season ever, 67
wins. They did. Only a couple teams have had a better year than San Antonio. Nobody's talking about it because the Warriors set an all-time mark.
Now, we talked about it on the NBA team podcast with Will from Texas. I somehow got Will from Texas to under 2 hours. I'm very proud of that.
I met Will and I met Pete, and those guys are solid dudes, and I loved having the Place to Be Nation tailgate with those guys. Will, Pete, you guys are A-OK. Even if you're a Spurs fan. Go, Spurs, go!
Like the Spurs beating the Thunder there?
I do think the Spurs will, with the home court advantage that they have, that only, you know, the only team that beat the Spurs was a historic team at home. So the home court advantage, I think they'll even steal a game in OKC. So, you know, you won't see a sweep, but you will see a 5 or 6 game Spurs victory over Oklahoma City, although all the games will be somewhat competitive.
Okay, the main event, I guess, for many, Western Conference Finals. We just saw that 30 for 30, this magic. Can you sing this magic moment, Todd Weiler?
This magic moment.
Okay, do we see the sweep there like the Bulls did to the Magic?
No, it will not be fo-fo-fo. Was that Moses Malone?
Well, it was fo-fi-fo, and the way you're going, it might be fo-fi-fo, because they're going to lose one to the Clippers, like you said.
If Golden State, and that could be tough. It depends if Chris Paul goes bonzo-gonzo, has a surreal series. And DeAndre Jordan, they don't have anybody in the middle at Golden State. I mean, they have Bogut and they have Draymond, but DeAndre Jordan can change games, especially in the playoffs. And we haven't seen him. If he's got his head right, he can really, really be something. He's terrible at the free throw line. So if Golden State and their depth foul him a lot, you know, you could see Hack and DeAndre. Boy, I would hate to see that in the playoffs.
Oh, we've seen it already. And then Spurs-Warriors.
Spurs-Warriors, I'm going to say Warriors in 6, but every game will be somewhat close. Mm-hmm. But I think Spurs-Warriors are the real NBA Finals.
Conference Finals in the East?
It's going to be, it's so easy to say Toronto-Cleveland. I am going to say, my heart wants to say Boston-Cleveland. I'm not a Boston fan at all, but I think that would be such a cool series to see.
Well, Boston is going to get Cleveland in the second round there.
That's right. You told me that twice, and I still don't believe it.
you don't want to believe it.
I don't want to believe it. Unfortunately, it's going to be Cleveland versus Toronto in the NBA Finals. I think Toronto gets the monkey off their back, advances to the next round, and then ultimately advances to the conference finals.
And then finals, you're saying Cleveland, a rematch, Cleveland versus Golden State.
I don't see anybody else coming out of the East.
Does this one go 6?
No. This one, as things have tweaked, I think this one is going to be still, I think this one goes 6. I think that's an easier call than saying 5 or a sweep. So what do you think?
I see Cleveland getting there. But I think the Warriors are going to lose to the Spurs.
Wow. Well,
I think the Warriors are going to lose to the Spurs.
Like I said, it's going to be very competitive. Every game is going to be tight. But, boy, that's going to be tough. That's going to be tough to see. Warriors, have spent so much energy on this regular season. So you have to wonder, but they've got that depth. And if everybody's healthy, I don't think anybody's out right now. You have Varejao, and he can do a lot of the dirty work along with Bogut, you know, that you have to have.
Well, that's another thing for Warriors. They have been so blessed with the health. I mean, blessed. I mean, Curry and Thompson combined, I believe, have missed seven games, you know, this year.
Yeah, and Curry especially, which is interesting, is Curry started out his career being snake bitten by injuries. So it's been a nice stretch where, you know, you've had them. And think about the numbers he would have if they played him in the fourth quarter this year.
Mm-hmm.
He's been out, you know, they've been preserving his health, or they've been so far ahead of the games that, okay, let's let Livingston ride.
They mentioned that when he had the 46 points in like 23 shots in 30 minutes when they broke the record to make it 73-9 against the Grizzlies. And then that was in concurrence at the same time with Kobe Bryant going for 60, but on 50 shot attempts, 22.
That never happened. I refuse to believe that is even worth anybody talking about.
Will you miss Kobe Bryant?
No.
Now, do you say that in a way of like, oh, I'm glad he's gone because he tortured my team, or I hate him?
I think he's a bad human being. I think he was a millennial before there were millennials.
Uh-huh.
You know, everything is about Kobe. Even I hated him being one of the first players in a long time to come from high school into the pros. He was drafted at 13. Is that right?
He was 19. He was 19 years old.
No, I'm not age 13. I mean the 13th pick.
Yes, he was the 13th pick, and they traded him for Vlade Divac. It was a setup draft pick. Yeah.
I mean, they had the agreement because he would not play. Coming out of high school saying you're not going to play for the Charlotte Hornets, coming out of high school, I was lucky if a girl would call me back. I'd never have liked Kobe. I respect the talent. Absolutely amazing athlete. Strong will. Going back out there after, you know, walking off with his – coming back from the Achilles injuries, everything – initially it was funny because they got Kobe and he seemed like I couldn't tell Eddie Jones and Kobe apart. They were so similar back in the day, but Kobe got to be such an excellent shooter that he would free up that space for himself. Great penetrator, such a great vertical leap. And those games where he just killed us. But when Kobe Bryant can elbow Mike Bibby and Mike Bibby gets the call for the foul in game six, the 2002
finals.
You are
not going to let this go, Tyler.
What am I supposed to do?
Yeah, but you have a good point about Eddie Jones and Kobe early on, because I think Eddie had like the grown man mustache. Like he had like the mustache that seemed like it was almost like going inward. Like it was so deep, you know. Even you just got me all hooked up on Eddie Jones all of a sudden. It was weird.
90s Lakers. It was kind of late 90s Lakers.
Late 90s. Well, you know, they did that documentary like we talked about, and the funny part was that Jerry West, one of the reasons he moved Vlade is that he needed the cap room to get Shaq in the max contract, because they had to get him to $120 million because Alonzo had just gotten $110 million from the Miami Heat. So Shaq's agents wanted the same amount. At the time, there was no cap. So Jerry West had to get like almost like Pat Riley in Miami. He had to get super creative in order to appease all these guys with max deals and just kind of makeshift with the rest of the roster. So he had to move Vlade's contract so that they can make the numbers work so that he can max out Shaq at $20 million a year. And then he drafted Kobe Bryant with that trade. You know,
so they got Kobe on a rookie scale for years. You know, how long before he signed his first big one?
It was three. It was after the lockout that he signed. After the lockout short season, he signed his
99.
Extension.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a little different now. Now we're at a point in the NBA where you can. I don't want to say you could. You could kind of shackle them a little bit with their contracts, but I mean, you got them for 4 years. You know, like Kawhi Leonard, he had to wait until 2015 to get paid. You know, it's a little different now. You know, you got your prospects there with a. Well, I guess you can call Ben McLemore a prospect just in terms of like name. And
Seth,
then
3 years and we still haven't seen any consistency out of him. He's had flashes, but you know, he's also had instability as an organization. But they're gonna one more year.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I am a Kentucky guy, so I always root for Willie Cauley-Stein. And then you got, you know, Boogie there.
He got crucified for the Stein pick, and he's been a fine player when Carl would actually play him. Carl doesn't play young players. He doesn't develop players. But Stein, in the games, changes the game defensively. He's an athletic defender and rebounder. Offensive game has come a long way, and he benefits from the attention that Cousins gathers.
Yeah, and it's a young man's game, and it's a player's game, and guess what?
He runs the floor.
That gets your ass fired. Yep.
Yeah.
Todd Weber, it was great to have you. Hopefully we can get you back on here. We could talk maybe something about the Kings when they're good.
Yeah, well, don't hold your breath on that one.
What'll be first? The Kings are in the playoffs, or this podcast is still on the network?
This podcast is never leaving the network. You know why?
Why is that?
Dependably comes out every week or every 2 weeks.
Every week, 2 weeks, maybe three, depending on where Adam Murray is flying this week.
I have a feeling,
or depending on how late I sleep and how good my Skype recorder is.
Yeah, and you know, we're both young dad. You're a young dad. I'm a middle-aged dad. You know, that's a lot to ask for. You guys, you're doing great. You and Adam are doing a great job with this pod, and I listen as often as I can. I'm still weeks behind, but you know, I've got so many queued up, not just from Place to Be Nation, but all over the league. The Vertical. Do you listen to The Vertical?
The one with Woj. I listened to his, and I listened to the one with JJ Redick.
Oh yeah, I won't do that because he's a dirty, filthy, stinky LA Clipper. But I appreciate the talent. And he went to Duke too, right?
Yes, he did. That's a double whammy.
Game over, man. Game over.
All right, and that's gonna be closing out this Eastern Conference playoff preview. I'm so glad to bring Todd Weber on. Thank you for thank you for having me. Almost did the reverse. That's your job.
Thank you for having me, Andrew. We're off to do this again, and we could talk. We could talk NBA all night, I think.
Can I have you at any time?
Not any time, but you know, buy me dinner. We'll see.
Hey, you're a sophisticated man. You have many books on your shelf. But thank you, Todd, and everybody. Just keep tuning in as the playoffs. We should have Adam back soon. We're going to be having also a Western Conference preview with some of my friends, that local friends, that Ryan Arena, Norman Rockwell. People will be looking forward to that. But on behalf of Todd Weber, this is Andrew Reich. Take care, guys.
Go Celtics.